Ra's death was complete. Tenji's grandson, Mormu, became heavenly sovereign in 697. The 14-year-old boy continued the task that Tenji had begun, and in 701 issued the first surviving set of laws from Japan. The Taiho Ritsu Ryo, or Great Treasure, enfolded the legal work Tenji had begun within it. It outlined a thoroughly well-controlled country, one where authority was laid out in an elaborate series of branching bureaucracies, each with its own set of ranks and offices. It was a beautifully structured set of laws, and the world it envisioned was just as orderly as the concentric rings of authority laid out in the edicts of the Great Reform. But despite several royal generations of intense borrowing, the Tang-inspired decrees had a stronger existence on paper than in reality. The Tang template had been laid over the Japanese islands, but beneath the template, vast swaths of the country ran along just as they had before. The clan leaders might hold bureaucratic ranks instead of noble titles, but they exercised the same authority. The land might belong to the crown in name, but it was still farmed and divided, ploughed and shaped by the same men who had owned it before the reforms. Not long after issuing his legal code, Mormu died at the age of 25 and was succeeded on the throne by his mother. Gemei, daughter of the heavenly sovereign Tenji, was the fifth woman to sit on the throne within a matter of decades, a preponderance of female rulers almost unknown elsewhere in the medieval world. Like the tip of an ancient pyramid, the heavenly sovereign touched the divine and connected it to the people at the base. Whether a man or woman occupied that position at the pyramid's tip was relatively unimportant. In the culture of the Tang Chinese, where trade routes and food supplies lay under the emperor's purview, only a woman, unusually talented at administration and people management, could convince her court that she was worthy of their loyalty. But Gemei was not a Tang monarch, despite her court's adoption of all those Tang customs, and she could act as the pole star of her people, regardless of her gender. In the third month of her reign, Gemei announced that her capital would be at Nara, a city to which Heavenly Sovereign Mormu had intended to move before his plans were cut short by death. Until this point, the capital city of the Yamato rulers had been movable. Each ruler declared his or her residence to be the new center of government, but Gemei's new capital was an innovation. The city, which was known to her as Heijo, the City of Peace, would remain the capital for the next 80 years, the Nara period of Japan. She also had new plans drawn up for its enlargement and glorification, plans modelled, naturally, on the layout of the Tang capital of Chang'an. The glories of Chang'an had deeply impressed the Japanese visitors to the capital city. In the past, the dwelling place of the heavenly sovereign had been a minor matter, because the sovereign was a locus of heavenly power, not earthly power. There was no need for earthly power to accrue in a physical place, no sense that a stone senate building, a royal court, or even a throne was necessary to connect the heavenly sovereign's rule to the earth. But over the next decades, as the ruler remained at Nara, she would gain a slightly less tenuous connection with the political establishment. The pole star would not merely shine. It would reach meddlesome hands into earthly matters. At the same time, the pole star would claim greater and greater divinity. Gemei abdicated in 714 in favor of her daughter, heavenly sovereign Gensho, and in the middle of her 9-year reign, Gensho presided over the publication of the Yoro Code. The code put into words an idea that had been growing in popularity, that the heavenly sovereign not only touched the divine but was, herself, godlike. The pole star did not relay heavenly illumination. It was the source. During the rule of the next heavenly sovereign, Gensho's younger brother, Shomu, a new foundation was carefully built underneath the shaky, already erected structure of Japanese royal privilege. For a Yamato king, Shomu ruled in unprecedented grandeur, with an elaborate court, a rabbit warren of bureaucrats, and all the trappings of full kingship. And he commissioned something that was, so far, missing, an ancient past for the Yamato kings. During his reign, the first mythical histories of Japanese kingship, the Kojiki and the Nihon Shoki, were written. According to these accounts, the first Yamato king had been the grandson of the sea god and the great-great-grandson of the sun goddess. With the blood of both sea and sky running in his veins, the boy Jimmu rose to rule his people. As a grown man, he gathered his sons together and gave them a charter. Long ago, he told them, the world had been given over to widespread desolation, to darkness, disorder, and gloom. But then the gods had given man a gift, the leadership of the imperial house. Under the heavenly sovereign, darkness and chaos had given way to beauty and order, and the land had become a place of fertility and light, good crops, and peaceful days and nights. But the remote regions do not yet enjoy the blessings of imperial rule, he told them. Every town has always been allowed to have its lord, and every village its chief, who, each one for himself, makes division of territory and practices mutual aggression and conflict. Those lands will undoubtedly be suitable for the extension of the heavenly task, so that its glory should fill the universe. Why should we not proceed there? And so they did, marching behind the God King on their way to drive out chaos and darkness. It had become vital to lay a myth foundation for Japanese kingship, even if that myth foundation had to be partially constructed out of nothing. The histories of Japanese kingship created a past full of righteous warfare and divine approval, and that past was carefully thrust underneath the present. It recreated Yamato Japan as a country founded on heroism, legendary feats of strength, and the favor of the gods. Chapter 44. The Days of the Empress. Between 683 and 712, the Empress Wu Zetian becomes the Son of Heaven. In 683, the crippled Emperor Tang Gaozong hovered at the edge of death, with his devoted Empress Wu Zetian at his side. Despite a series of strokes, his mind was still clear. He called his chief minister to the Hall of Audience in the Royal Palace, so that he could make his final choice of an heir known, and gave his last instructions for the transfer of power. Later that same night, he died in the hall, too weak to move to his bedchamber. He had chosen his 27-year-old son, Zhang Zong, to be the next emperor, and had designated Zhang Zong's 2-year-old son, Li Chongzhao, as heir apparent grandson, a highly unusual move, reflecting his own fears that the relatively young Tang dynasty had not yet established itself firmly on the throne. He had also issued a last order, that the new emperor consult Empress Wu whenever important matters of defense and administration cannot be decided. He had intended this triple pronouncement to protect Tang power, and it did, although not quite in the way he had intended. With the power to make final decisions enshrined in her husband's last words, the empress removed her son after barely 2 months of rule. His offense was simple. He had made his wife's father his chief minister, which was a clear hint to his mother that it was time for her to retire to decent seclusion and give over the empress's throne to her daughter-in-law. The empress, who had no intention of doing so, sent palace guards to surround Tang Zhongzong as he gave a public audience. They arrested the startled emperor and led him off to house arrest, along with his pregnant wife. Instead of elevating the heir apparent grandson, Empress Wu then appointed her own younger son, Zhang Zong's brother, Ruizong, to be the new Tang Emperor. Tang Ruizong, in his early 20s, was intelligent but shy, and afflicted with a crippling stutter. He had no choice but to let his mother rule on his behalf. Political affairs were decided by the Empress Dowager, one court historian records. She installed Ruizong in a detached palace, and he had no chance to participate. None of this was exactly legal, but nor was it entirely illegal. The empress had not, after all, claimed the throne, although a decree 6 months after Ruizong's accession deepened the suspicions that she intended to do so. The decree, the Act of Grace, changed the colors of imperial banners, the styles of dress at court, and the insignia of court officials. This was the act of a ruler founding a new dynasty, the symbolism of change. People muttered, but Tang China was temporarily prosperous and peaceful. The farmers and peasants were well fed and well supplied, and the general agitation needed for mass revolt was missing. An armed revolt against her de facto usurpation did break out, led by a nobleman whose family had been exiled not long before, but within 3 months the empress's soldiers had quelled it. Over the next 5 years, the empress moved from strength to strength. As the power behind her husband's throne, she had already proved herself to be a competent administrator, military strategist, and lawmaker. Yet despite her obvious abilities, the aristocrats of the court continued to resent the fact that the former concubine had risen to a power they could only dream of. So the empress turned to her own people, choosing her officials from the lower classes. men of ability whose birth had previously cut them off from advancement. The aristocrats would never be her friends, but they grudgingly had to admit her strengths as a ruler. Now the common people became her loyal supporters as well, grateful for the chance to rise through talent alone. But that was not the only brick in the base of her power. She also created a secret police, headed by the two notorious officials Zhao Xing and Lai Junchen, author of the interrogator's handbook called Classic of Entrapment, who earned the same somber notoriety as Himmler and his aides have gained in modern times. They formed a school where they taught their trade to disciples, composed a book of instructions, and elaborated many new and frightful tortures to extract confessions. These contrivances they decorated with poetic names and displayed the terrifying battery to a newly arrested victim who would often confess anything to avoid these tortures. The Empress's power was supported not only by the men who were grateful for their elevation to high office, but also by all the others who were too frightened to object. In 690, the Empress took the final step. One of her officials asked her to assume the title Emperor, Son of Heaven. Like the first Sui Emperor and the usurpers who had come before him, she refused, a customary act that meant nothing. A second petition signed by 60,000 of her subjects was presented. Again, she refused. From his secluded palace, Tang Ruizong realized that he stood at the edge of a precipice. He presented the third and final petition himself, asking that his mother do him the favor of removing him from the throne. The Empress Wu agreed, graciously. She was coronated on September the 24th, 690, and Ruizong was demoted to the position of heir apparent, in which he lived peacefully, in the safety created by his willingness to lay down power. With this formal recognition of her authority, the Empress Wu became emperor. Yet there was no clear path in any of the ancient rituals through which a woman could claim to be the true mandate of heaven. In order to have any hope of bolstering her real political power with sacred sanction, the Empress had to assume a new persona. She had to become, like all of the emperors before her, a son of heaven. And so, for purposes of court ceremonies, she put on a very particular illusion of masculinity. She did not change her dress or appearance, she did not try to appear male, but she stepped into a created male persona with which the entire country, having no way to place a female ruler into the complex patterns of the past, agreed to interact. She named herself the first emperor of a new dynasty, the Zhao, which put her in an appropriately patriarchal role. She moved the court back to Luoyang, creating a space between her rule as emperor and her previous tenure as empress. It was a fiction unlike any that had been practiced in China before. The new emperor's administration, which now boasted scores of talented, well-trained, competent, low-born men, was one of the strongest in recent history. Despite the black thread of terror woven through her power, the emperor was clearly capable of keeping Tang China strong and prosperous, yet there seems to have been no way for the Empress Wu to claim the throne without taking on this new identity. The willingness of the population to accept her as the Son of Heaven reveals not only the strength of the construct, but also the extent to which it was now detached from reality. For the first 5 years of the Emperor Wu's new dynasty, Tang China flourished, although not without a constant current of resentment and complaint from the aristocrats who had been nudged out of power by Wu's new appointees. But the loyalty of the elevated commoners continued strong, and the emperor knew how to find sympathetic allies for her causes, be they political or personal. She took a lover, a salesman of medical herbs named Cui Huayi, who became troublesome. Since there was certainly no space in the old rituals for the emperor to have a male concubine, she appointed him to be the abbot of one of the Buddhist monasteries she had endowed, a position that gave him the right to enter and leave the palace freely. He took advantage of his position to become jealous and possessive, finally burning down one of the great Buddhist temples in the city in a fit of rage. The emperor picked the strongest ladies-in-waiting at court and sent them to surround Huayi and strangle him. The women of the Tang court had suffered a long time from the whims of royal men. She had no difficulty finding volunteers. In 695, she faced a triple uprising in the north. The northern nomadic tribes, known as the Khitan, who had originally lived somewhere around the Liao River, had moved south towards the Tang border and now were in the vicinity of the northern city of Beijing, headquarters of the northern military governor. At the same time, the Eastern Turkish Khaganate, which had been under Tang rule since Tang Taizong's conquest in 630, rebelled. The Turks of the Eastern Khaganate had grown increasingly unhappy with their place in Tang society. They had given up their empire and fought in the Tang armies, and in return they had gotten nothing but scorn and dismissive treatment. "For whose benefit are we conquering realms?" they complained. Descendants of the old royal family still lived, and one of them, a man named Mo Cho, led the Eastern Turks in a rebellion. While the Khitan were invading Beijing, the Turks, under Mo Cho, were raiding the northwestern frontier. At the same time, the Tibetans began to launch attacks against the Tang land in the Tarim Basin. The Tibetan king, Mangson Mangtsen, guarded by the regent, Ga Tongtsen, had survived his infancy, against all odds, and then died in his 20s. By that point, Ga Tongtsen was also dead, and Tibet was now controlled by Ga Tongtsen's son, Kri Bring, acting as regent for Mangson Mangtsen's young son, Tridu Songtsen. The double passing on of power, regent to regent, emperor to emperor, provided the Tibetan Empire with enough stability so that the conquests begun by Tridu Songtsen's great-grandfather, Songtsen Gampo, could resume. The timing of the attacks suggests that the three enemy armies were in some kind of communication. The driving force behind all three was probably the Eastern Turkish leader, Mo Cho, who now began to work the situation to his advantage. He suggested to the Khitan that they attack. Once their invasion was underway, he sent messengers to Emperor Wu offering to fight the Khitan on behalf of the Tang, in return for very large payments. The former empress agreed to this plan. Mo Cho attacked and defeated the Khitan in 696. Then, after collecting his fee, he went right back to attacking the Tang again. Within a few years, he had managed to rebuild the power of the Eastern Khaganate. The Tibetans, meanwhile, conquered the southern part of the Tarim Basin, and Tibetan armies marched into China, getting as far as 200 miles west of Chang'an itself. This was as far as they could extend themselves without danger of collapse, so they accepted the emperor's offer of a buyout, took the money, and retreated. The defeat of the Tang armies in battle made it harder for the former empress to maintain the illusion that she was the son of heaven. As so many aging emperors had done before her, the Emperor Wu, now in her 70s, reassured herself of her potency and her power through the pleasures of the flesh. She began a dual affair with two brothers, both with the family name of Zhang. She granted them so many favors that they became the two most hated men at court, and her officials began to worry that the brothers might be able to talk her into making them her successors. An increasing number of court officials began to suggest that the retired Zhong Zong should be brought back out of obscurity and restored to the throne. To silence them, the emperor brought Zhong Zong out of his 14 years of house arrest and declared him to be her successor, the heir apparent, despite the fact that he had already been emperor once. He was nearly 50 and had led a quiet life in semi-seclusion with his wife and children. With the amiability that had kept him alive up until this point, he accepted the title and did not press for more. Emperor Wu had held on to her health and strength for an extraordinarily long time, but now she began to weaken. She suffered the first major illness of her life in 699, and despite doses from court alchemists, further spells of sickness followed. By 705, the empress was 80 years old and ready for retirement. She abdicated, handing the crown over to her son Zhong Zong, and took to her bed. There she remained for the next year, apparently still popular with her people, holding audiences in bed like the grandmother of the entire nation, until she died, filled with years and glory. With the emperor dead, the court records almost unanimously ignored her attempts to found a new dynasty, and went right back to chronicling the years of the Tang. Zhong Zong ascended as the fifth Tang ruler, or as the sixth, depending on whether or not his 2 months in power back in 683 was counted as a separate reign. The pliancy that had saved him did not make him a good ruler. For the 5 years of his reign, from 705 until 710, the Tang court was run by his wife, the Empress Wei, and her lover, the emperor's cousin, Wu Sanxi. Empress Wei had ambitions to be like her mother-in-law, but she lacked both the Emperor Wu's intelligence and competence. Within 5 years, the court was a disastrous, corrupt mess. The empress capped the disaster by poisoning her husband Zhong Zong in 710. After surviving decades of court intrigue, the unfortunate man was finally brought down by a plate of cakes. Empress Wei, who was not an original thinker, then tried to install her husband's young son by a concubine as emperor, so that she could be regent, just as the Empress Wu had done 3 decades before. But the court was now familiar with this routine, and a palace rebellion led by the dead emperor's sister and nephew ended with the young ruler imprisoned and the Empress Wei, along with a score of her relatives and supporters, dead in the palace hallways. The rebels then declared Ruizong, Zhong Zong's younger brother, to be the next emperor. Ruizong, now 48, had, like his brother, already been emperor once. He had been coronated at the age of 22, back in 684, and had ruled for 6 years under his mother's thumb, until she had deposed him and declared herself emperor. Ruizong had gone back to private life after his removal from the throne. He liked obscurity and did not want to re-enter the palace fray, but he finally allowed himself to be talked into returning to imperial life. In 710, he was re-coronated, but by 712, he was fed up with court intrigue. When a comet appeared in the sky, he hailed it as an omen and abdicated. He handed the crown over to his son, who became the Emperor Tang Xuanzong. Tang Xuanzong, energetic and mature, began to reform the mess left in his father's wake. He cut the government tax breaks for Buddhist monasteries, which forced a number of monks and nuns to return to civilian tax-paying life. He reinstituted the Confucian system of choosing officials through a series of examinations, which weakened the power of the aristocratic families that tended to monopolize court positions through claiming the privilege of blood. He drove back the Tibetans and forced them to sue for peace. He stabilized the frontiers by setting up a series of command zones along the trouble spots and giving a military governor vast powers to deal with any difficulties. And he moved the capital back to Chang'an, which, thanks to his new tax policies and the relative peace of the frontiers, began once again to attract trade caravans from as far away as Constantinople. Unlike the Emperor Wu, he was able to pour his entire energies into ruling. None of it went towards transforming his power into legitimacy. He would rule for nearly half a century, bringing the Tang dynasty back from the edge of disintegration to the height of its glory, and earning himself the name Brilliant Emperor. Chapter 45. Paths into Europe. Between 705 and 732, Arab armies destroy the Visigoths, fail to capture Constantinople, and are turned back from Frankish land by Odo of Aquitaine and Charles Martel. The latest general turned emperor of Constantinople, Tiberius III, sat uneasily on the throne. He had received bad news. The young emperor who had been dethroned and mutilated, Justinian the Noseless, had escaped from his prison in Cherson. He was at the court of the Khazars, plotting to get his throne back. The Khazar Khans had driven back the Arabs and conquered old Great Bulgaria, which made the current Khan, Busir Glavan, the strongest ally around. But the Khazars had also been allies of the legitimate Byzantine emperors since the days of Heraclius. In order to convince Busir Glavan to help him overthrow the man who currently wore the crown, Justinian the Noseless promised him something he didn't yet have, and couldn't get by fighting, the chance to be kin to the Byzantine throne. He offered to marry Busir Glavan's sister in exchange for help getting his throne back. Busir Glavan agreed. Shortly afterwards, a secret message came from Tiberius of Constantinople. He would pay the Khan handsomely to assassinate Justinian. Busir Glavan was a realist. Justinian would have to fight to get the throne back, and political alliance now was worth more than blood alliance with a man who might be emperor sometime in the uncertain future. He accepted Tiberius's money and told off 2 Khazar soldiers to murder his new brother-in-law. But he had underestimated Justinian. Warned by his wife that something was afoot, Justinian summoned the 2 soldiers to his house, probably under the pretense that he wanted to hire them as bodyguards. He welcomed them in and, when they were relaxed, strangled both of them with a cord. He then fled again, this time in a fishing boat, and escaped from the Khazar territory. He managed to pilot the boat north into the Dniester River, crossing as he did so into the first Bulgarian Empire. Asbaruk's son, Tervel, now ruled over the Bulgarians, and he was an enemy of the Khazars, who had ravaged the original Bulgarian homeland farther east. Justinian convinced Tervel to support him with promises of alliance, cash, and the eventual marriage of his own daughter to Tervel. And in 705, Justinian was able to lead a Bulgarian army to the walls of Constantinople. They spent 3 days trying to negotiate their way into the city before the ex-emperor lost patience. Familiar with Constantinople's drainage system, he led his army in through a water main. They stormed the palace and seized Tiberius. Justinian reclaimed the throne and ordered Tiberius put to death. He also returned the favor of his mutilation by blinding the patriarch, who had supported Tiberius's rule. Justinian II's second rule lasted 6 years, from 705 to 711. He was the only emperor who reigned after mutilation. He wore a silver nose to cover the hole where his own nose had been, and the people of Constantinople found it useful to pretend that the nose was real. But his second reign proved to be nothing more than a single-minded hunt for those who had betrayed him the first time around. The 6 years became a reign of terror, as he ordered enemies and suspected enemies to be hung on the walls, trampled by horses in the arena, thrown in the sea in sacks, poisoned and beheaded. In 711 the army rose up and murdered him. No natural successor or strong general was able to pick up the reins of power. Between 711 and 717, three ephemeral emperors claimed and lost the throne of Constantinople. But the armies of Islam, occupied elsewhere, did not immediately take advantage of this weakness. The caliph Abd al-Malik had died in 705, and his son, Walid I, was acclaimed as his successor. With Walid I in power, the Arab armies began to move off the North African beach. The governor, Musa ibn Nusayr, had been appointed to the Islamic province of North Africa, Ifriqiya. He in turn appointed as his military commander a Berber soldier named Tariq bin Ziyad, who had once been a slave but had earned his freedom through military service. Together, the governor and the new commander led an assault on the coastal city of Tangiers. They hoped that Tangiers could serve as a staging point for the Arab armies to cross the mouth of the Mediterranean Sea and move into the Visigothic kingdom of Hispania. The realm of the Visigoths was ready to fall. For nearly a century, the Visigoths had been struggling to keep their kingdom whole. An early hint of their difficulties had already appeared in 636, when the Fifth Council of Toledo, the gathering of priests, scholars, and officials that made the country's laws, decreed that only a Gothic noble of Gothic blood could ever be king. In 653, the Eighth Council of Toledo added another stipulation. The king not only would be a Goth, but also would be chosen by the great nobility, the Goths of the powerful families. This wrote into law the old Germanic custom of electing warriors to be kings, a practice that most of the other Germanic kingdoms had slowly abandoned. It was a dynamic practice that suited a wandering people well, but in a settled country with customs and laws, the combination of election and royal prerogative was a volatile one. An elected president knows his power to be limited and his time brief, and approaches his new task circumspectly. An elected king comes into an administration with which he has no continuity, and begins to exercise autocratic power. The chances to make enemies were endless. The Toledo decrees reveal a country in which the hope of stability, of some continuity between administrations, of the continued pursuing of shared goals, lay not in laws, in constitution, or in the existence of a royal family, but simply in the assurance that the king would be of Gothic blood. But as the Arab armies approached, this stability was showing itself to be an illusion. In 694, the king of the Visigoths, Egica, had appointed as co-ruler his 8-year-old son, Witiza, and had followed this up with a coronation ceremony around 700, when Witiza reached adulthood, at the age of 14 or so. Egica was already unpopular because he had claimed some of the land designated for the use of the king as his own personal property, an act that erased the line between the king's rights as a ruler and his rights as a private person. The coronation of Egica's young son was a clear attempt to introduce dynastic right to the throne into the Visigothic succession. It had been resented both by the nobles who prized their right to choose a king and by the nobles who thought they had a chance to be chosen. But the desire to revolt against Egica's presumption was temporarily quenched by an outbreak of plague, so severe that the capital city was deserted by anyone who could afford to get out. Egica and Witiza left Toledo in 701, and Egica died shortly afterwards, possibly of the sickness. Although we know little about Witiza's solo reign, One contemporary chronicle mentions that he returned the land his father had claimed to the royal fisc, transferring it from his personal ownership back into the service of the throne. He was young, but he must have seen the resistance to his father's innovations. The gesture did not save him. By 711, Witizar had disappeared from the historic record. His fate remains a mystery, but another king, named Ruderic, sat on the throne with the support of the Gothic nobles. The events that follow are unclear, the accounts confused and contradictory, but mentions of two other kings in different parts of Hispania suggest that support for Ruderic was not unanimous among the Gothic nobles, and that civil war erupted. The system of election, meant to put competent kings on the throne while avoiding blood succession, broke down just at the moment that an attacking army was on its way. The army was a mix of Arabs and Berbers, commanded by the Berber general Tariq bin Ziyad. Coastal raids on southern Visigoth towns had already begun. Ruderic assembled what defense he could muster, but some sources hint that his competitors for the throne had already allied themselves with the invaders, possibly even assisting Tariq's entrance into Hispania. If so, they had overestimated the goodwill of the newcomers. On July 19, 711, Tariq bin Ziyad and his troops met Ruderic at the Battle of Guadalete, and in a shattering defeat, Ruderic, his noblemen, and his officers were massacred. "God killed Ruderic and his companions and gave the Muslims the victory," writes the Arab chronicler Ibn Abd al-Hakam, "and there was never in the West a more bloody battle than this." This brought an abrupt end to the Visigothic kingdom in Spain, not because the king was dead, but because almost the entire stratum of aristocrats, the men who held the right to elect the monarch, was wiped out. There was no more king, and, more damaging, no one who could claim the right to appoint one. No one had the authority to organize a resistance or to negotiate a treaty with the invaders. For the next 7 years, the Arab and Berber army fought its way across the country, conquering and negotiating with local officials. Tariq himself was recalled from Hispania after a single year, and the newly conquered territory, now known as the Islamic province of Al-Andalus, was placed under the command of the governor of North Africa. In 715, the Caliph Walid I died, leaving as his legacy the Arab entrance into Europe. His younger brother, Suleiman, took up the Caliph's mantle and immediately refocused the energies of the Islamic armies on the Byzantine borders. Byzantium was still suffering from turnover at the top of the chain of command. The third of three temporary and passing emperors, Theodosius III, sat on the throne. Author's note: the city administrator, Philippikos, 711 to 713, had been replaced first by his secretary Anastasios II, 713 to 715, and then by the tax official Theodosius III, 715 to 717. He was a harmless tax official who had been elevated much against his will. In fact, Theophanes the Confessor says that he hid in the woods when he discovered that his soldiers were planning to acclaim him, and he had no stomach for facing the gathering Arab attack. When the armies at Nicaea proclaimed one of their generals, the Syrian Leo, as emperor, Theodosius abdicated with relief and went to a monastery, where he trained for the priesthood and eventually became bishop of Ephesus, a job much more to his liking. The soldier Leo, now Emperor Leo III, brought an end to the chaos in Constantinople. He prepared at once for an expected Arab assault, and within a matter of months the Arab ships, a fleet 1,800 strong, were sighted passing through the Dardanelles, the strait at the far end of the Sea of Marmara. They were under the command of the new caliph, Suleiman. At the same time, Suleiman had sent a ground force of 80,000 around through Asia Minor. The ships drew close to the city from the south, just as the troops were arriving from the east. The entrance into the Golden Horn, the harbour at Constantinople, was protected by a giant chain. The ground forces would have had to fight their way forward and lift the chain to allow the ships into the harbour. Before they could do so, Leo III launched an attack force of burning ships, set alight with unquenchable Greek fire into the approaching fleet. The wind was with him. Hundreds of the Arab ships were set on fire and either sank or went aground. Suleiman regrouped his remaining ships, at which point Leo III himself unhooked the chain, closing off the Golden Horn, and opened the harbour. "The enemy thought he wanted to entice them and would stretch the chain out again," writes Theophanes, "and they did not dare to come in to anchor. Instead, they retreated, anchoring at a nearby inlet." Before they could reorganize their attack, two disasters struck them. A sharp and unusually severe winter suddenly descended. For 100 days crystalline snow covered the earth, says Theophanes, and Suleiman grew ill and died. His cousin Umar was proclaimed caliph in Damascus, the current capital of the Abbasid Empire, as Caliph Umar II. A new admiral was sent from Egypt. When he arrived in the spring, the attack resumed. But Leo III had arranged a new treaty with the Bulgarians, and a Bulgarian army arrived in midsummer to help lift the siege. Theophanes claims that 22,000 Arabs died in the battle before the walls. Umar II sent word that the siege should be abandoned, and the Arabs pulled out in great disgrace on August 15, 718, and started home. Once again, Constantinople had resisted the Arab flood. It still lay inaccessible to the Islamic conquest, blocking the eastern path into Europe. But the western path had proved much easier for the Arab armies. Almost no roadblocks had been flung into their way by the Visigoths. In 718, a flicker of resistance appeared. A Visigoth noble named Peleo retreated into the northern mountains with his followers and declared himself king of a Christian kingdom. The kingdom of Asturias, tiny and poverty-stricken, survived repeated Arab attacks thanks to its mountain defences. But it did nothing to halt the Arab advance. Under Al-Sam, the new governor of Al-Andalus, the Islamic army reached the edge of the old Visigothic land and came within hailing distance of the Frankish land known as Aquitaine. The Franks, like the Visigoths, like the Byzantines, had been suffering a slight crisis in leadership. The do-nothing Merovingian kings had been dominated for 40 years by a succession of ambitious mayors of the palaces. In 680, the Austrasian nobles had chosen a Frankish official named Pippin the Fat to occupy their palace. He was the grandson of Pippin the Elder, the mayor who had first tried to make the office hereditary back in 643. At his election, the throne of Austrasia was empty. Its last do-nothing king had just died. Pippin the Fat, later known as Pippin the Middle, since his grandson would also be named Pippin, refused to support a new candidate for the Austrasian crown. None of the Frankish nobles insisted, and Pippin the Fat ruled as de facto king of Austrasia. This did not please the Merovingian king who sat on the throne of Neustria, Theodoric III. He happened to be the youngest son of Clovis II, and had been retrieved from his monastery to ascend the throne after both of his brothers died. In 687, Theodoric III attacked Austrasia, but Pippin the Fat's army defeated the king so thoroughly that Theodoric had to agree to make Pippin the Fat the joint mayor of all three palaces, Austrasia, Neustria, and Burgundy. After this, Pippin the Fat had begun to call himself Dux et Princeps Francorum, Duke and Prince of the Franks. He was neither a king nor a servant of the king. He had returned to an older Germanic description of his power, calling himself the principal leader, princeps, among many leaders, duces, dukes. He ruled in Austrasia as Dux et Princeps for nearly 30 years, outliving various puppet kings of the Merovingian family, and died in 714 at age 80, just as the Arab armies were storming towards the Frankish border. This was bad timing. The various royal cousins who wore the Frankish crowns were not powerful enough to spearhead any effective defence, and Pippin's death left the mayoral offices empty as well. Both of his legitimate sons, born to his wife Plectrud, had died before him. He did have 2 illegitimate sons, the children of his mistress Alpaida. But Plectrud hated both Alpaida and her sons, and did not want them inheriting Pippin's power. Instead, she insisted that the real heirs to the office of mayor of the palace should be her grandsons, the children of her dead sons. To make sure that Alpaida's sons wouldn't get power, she nabbed the older and most ambitious son, Charles Martel, and imprisoned him in Cologne. Charles escaped from prison almost at once and returned to Neustria, where he had to fight Plectrud, acting as regent for her young grandsons, and various claimants to the office of mayor of the palace. The civil war lasted for 2 years, but by 717, Charles Martel had made himself mayor of the palace of Austrasia and had put a royal cousin on the throne as a do-nothing king. He had control, although it was shaky, over most of the Frankish lands. But to the south, a local nobleman named Odo, who had the hereditary right to govern the region known as Aquitaine, had taken the opportunity of the civil war to make himself more or less independent. He was supposed to be loyal to the Franks, but he reserved his loyalty for the do-nothing king. He was suspicious of Charles Martel's ambitions and kept himself aloof from any alliance with the mayor of the palace. As a result, when the Arab armies appeared on his southern border, Odo of Aquitaine had no powerful friends to come and help him out. On June 9th, 721, the tiny army of Aquitaine, reinforced by only a few resistance fighters from the mountains of Asturias, met the Arab armies at the Battle of Toulouse, under Odo's command. With staggering self-absorption, the Frankish chronicles make almost no mention of this battle. They are preoccupied with Charles Martel's rise to power. Odo of Aquitaine appears in them only as Charles Martel's enemy, not as the savior of the Franks. But Odo defeated the Arabs at the Battle of Toulouse, killing the governor of Al-Andalus in the fighting, and halted the Arab advance into Europe. It was one of the worst and most unexpected defeats suffered by an advancing Islamic army. He threw the Saracens out of Aquitaine, the chronicles remark laconically, and in doing so he preserved the culture of the Franks. The dead governor of Al-Andalus was replaced by a new appointee, the military man Al-Ghafiqi, and for a time the Arabs retreated from the Frankish border. Al-Ghafiqi spent 8 or so years governing Al-Andalus before leading an army back towards the northeast in 732. Once again, Odo of Aquitaine came out to meet the Arab attack. This time, Odo was horribly defeated at the Battle of the River Garonne. He was forced back into Aquitaine, and the Arab armies crossed the river, coming first to Bordeaux, then to Poitiers. According to the Chronicle of Fredegar, they burned churches and slaughtered the population as they went. Odo, in desperation, sent to Charles Martel, offering to swear his loyalty if Charles would come and help him. Up until this point, it seems, the Franks had not fully appreciated the danger of the Arab advance, but the previous decade had opened their eyes, and Charles Martel marched south at once, making Odo one of his commanders, and giving him authority over the Aquitaine wing of the army. The Arabs under Al-Ghafiqi and the Franks under Charles Martel met near Poitiers in October. The battles that followed went on for more than a week, with no clear advantage emerging. Days into the fighting, Al-Ghafiqi was killed. At his fall, the Arab forces began to retreat, and Charles Martel followed them. The Chronicle of Fredegar, which is relentlessly pro-Charles and anti-Odo, announces that Martel pursued the Arabs in retreat to grind them small, utterly destroy them, and scatter them like stubble. This is not exactly true. They had lost the battle, but they were not entirely defeated. They burned and looted their way back into Al-Andalus, more or less unhindered, while Martel came along behind. The battle at Poitiers in 732, immortalized by Frankish historians as the Battle of Tours, did turn the Arab advance back. The Muslim Empire halted at the border of Aquitaine and did not again press forward. Charles Martel's victory had been competent and well-planned, but his nickname, the Hammer, given to him because he hammered away at his enemies and ground them to dust, was not completely deserved. Odo of Aquitaine, now reduced to paying homage to the mayor of the palace, had orchestrated the triumph, but Charles Martel had better court historians. Chapter 46. The Kailasa of the South. Between 712 and 780, the Arab armies establish a province in the Sindh, and the southern Rashtrakuta build a reflection of the sacred north. The Arab armies, blocked at Constantinople and at Poitiers, had better fortune at the Indus. The conquest of the Sindh began back in 643, had halted when the Caliph Umar realized how desolate the area was. Now Al-Hajjaj, the governor of the eastern reaches of the Islamic Empire, recalled his son-in-law Muhammad bin Qasim from his military post in Fars and sent him back towards the Indus to finish the job. Bin Qasim's first target was the port city of Debal, right on the eastern edge of the Makran Desert. At this time, the port seems to have been under the control of a tribal leader named Tahir, who probably ruled not only his own tribe, but a few surrounding tribes as well. We know of him from the Arabic history Tariq-i-Hind wa Sindh, written sometime after the 8th century and translated from Arabic into Persian in the early 13th century. According to the anonymous author, when Bin Qasim marched towards Debal in 712, Tahir had just inherited control of the port from his father. He was not a very important ruler, but he stood as a barrier between the Arabs in Makran and the lands farther east. Rather than simply attacking him, Al-Hajjaj and Bin Qasim manufactured an excuse for their aggression. Pirates had attacked Arab ships setting off from the coast of the Makran, and Al-Hajjaj insisted that Tahir punish the sea raiders. Tahir, receiving this message, retorted that he had no authority over the pirates, which was undoubtedly true. He was not nearly as powerful as the Arabs seemed to think, but Al-Hajjaj took Tahir's response as hostile and authorized his son-in-law's attack. The two men were searching for reasons to invade, which suggests that the invasion of India may have been undertaken without the complete sanction of the Caliph in Damascus. Muhammad bin Qasim approached Debal by land, while further reinforcements and siege engines arrived by sea. Al-Hajjaj supervised the offensive by letter. Tariq-i-Hind says that he wrote every 3 days with instructions, which is as close to micromanaging as he could get, given the difficulties of 8th-century travel. After an extensive siege, Debal was taken. Dahir, seeing that the city was lost, withdrew with most of his men, and bin Qasim slaughtered the remaining defenders. He ordered a mosque to be built in Debal, left a garrison at the port, and kept marching eastward. Dahir fled to the other side of the Indus, abandoning the lands between the port and the river. All the villages surrender to bin Qasim as he approached. He did not believe, the Arab historian tells us, that bin Qasim would attempt to cross the river, but bin Qasim ordered a pontoon bridge, boats roped together to form a wavering wooden path laid across the Indus, stationing a boat full of archers at the head of the bridge and thrusting it forward a little farther as each boat was added behind. The archers kept Dahir's men at bay until the line of boats reached the far shore. Bin Qasim marched his men across the fragile bridge. A dreadful conflict ensued, the historian writes, with Dahir and his soldiers mounted on elephants, and the Arab soldiers shooting flaming arrows into the howdahs, the reinforced carriages on the elephants' backs. Towards evening, Dahir was knocked from his elephant by a well-placed arrow. An axeman on the ground beheaded him. His men retreated upriver and fortified themselves at the city of Brahmanabad, well to the northeast. But over the next 3 years, bin Qasim conquered a swath of land across the Indus that included Brahmanabad, which he made into his capital. The new Indian province proved to be a treasure trove for the eastern part of the empire. The tribes in the conquered land paid regular and expensive tribute to the occupiers. The 9th-century Persian historian Al-Baladuri writes that when the governor Al-Hajjaj reckoned up the tribute paid during the first year, his profit was double the cost of the conquest. The northern Indian lands were perpetually troubled by outsiders coming east across the Indus or south across the mountains, but a kind of cyclical indigenous battling, almost completely unaffected by outside forces, had characterized the south of India for centuries. The kingdoms of the south breathed, their borders expanding and contracting, each dynasty hanging on to power, but seeing the extent of that power change almost yearly. In the 8th century, the western Chalukya expanded again, dominating the south-central plain under its king Vikramaditya II. This was nothing new. Vikramaditya's conquests simply pushed the kingdom back to the same borders ruled by Pulakesi II a century earlier. But in 745, a new southern kingdom did arise, and its king not only travelled far enough north to encounter the outside invaders, but also tried to reproduce the northern geography in the south. His name was Dantidurga, and in 745 he inherited the rule of his southern tribe. His father had kidnapped his mother, a noblewoman of Chalukya birth, and married her by force. So Dantidurga had Chalukya blood in his veins, however unwillingly. With it had apparently come the compulsion for conquest. He started out by fighting his neighbours, with growing success. Sometime around 753, he decided that he was strong enough to take on Kirtivarman II, son and heir of the western Chalukya king Vikramaditya. A poem records the outcome of the battle during which Dantidurga apparently triumphed, despite his much smaller forces. Assisted by only a few, as if by a bend of his eyebrow, he did subdue that tireless emperor, Kirtivarman II, whose weapons were of undimmed edge. Kirtivarman II kept only a small remnant of his father's domain. Dantidurga claimed the rest and annexed it to his own territory. Immediately afterwards, Dantidurga pushed his way north across the Narmada. Kirtivarman II had been his greatest enemy in the south. In the north, his natural target was the tribal chief of the Pratihara, who ruled a territory that surrounded the city of Mandore and stretched all the way up into the Sindh. An outlying Arab force met Dantidurga as soon as he crossed over into the Sindh, but he drove them back and made his way straight for Mandore. In 754, he managed to reach the city and occupy it, forcing the Pratihari king, Nagabata, to surrender. But there was no conquest of the north. Dantidurga apparently did not have the men or the bureaucracy to rule a far-flung empire. He took tribute from Nagabata and went back south. As soon as he got back on the southern side of the Narmada, Nagabata came after him and recaptured all the northern territory. What Dantidurga's next move might have been will never be known. He died, like Alexander the Great, at the age of 32, only 2 years later. But he had penciled in the borders of the next great Indian power, the kingdom of the Rashtrakuta. He had come to the head of his tribe young, and his ceaseless campaigning had apparently left him no time for wife or children. He was succeeded as tribal leader and king by his uncle Krishna I. Krishna I went to work filling in the outlines with nearly 18 years of unceasing warfare. His great accomplishment was to bring down the Western Chalukya king and seize the remaining Western Chalukya lands for his own. Krishna never ventured as far north as his nephew, but the northern landscape apparently occupied his thoughts. In celebration of his victories, he commissioned a new temple to join the caves at Ellora. This temple, the Kailasa, or Krishnasvara, was carved out of the rock without seams. It was, in the words of one of his inscriptions, an astounding edifice that amazed even the best of the immortals. More than that, it was a mirror of the north. Kailasa was not just a name, it was the name of the peak in the northern Himalaya where the Ganges River, the source of life, originated. Kailasa was the highest and holiest place in the mountains, the sacred spot from which creation sprang. By building its reflection in the mountains that lined the Narmada River Valley, Krishna was proclaiming himself to be the southern equivalent to the ancient, godlike rulers of old, the mythological sovereigns of northern India. He was making the sloping, low Vindhya Mountains into Himalaya in the Deccan, a new sacred border. After Krishna's death, his son Dhruva once again invaded the north, something his father had never done. In 786 he seized Mandore, this time for good, and headed even farther north, towards Kanauj. Kanauj did not fall to him right away. The city lay at a three-way intersection of kingdoms, his own Rashtrakuta realm reaching up from the south, the Pratyahara, whose realm had shifted somewhat north and east and now extended over into the Ganges Valley, and the Pala, whose capital was the city of Gaur, closer to the Ganges Delta, but who had advanced westward as far as Kanauj. For the next century, Kanauj would remain at the battlefront between the three crowns, but even without possession of the northern city, Dhruva had managed to bring northern and southern land together under one throne. When he crossed the Ganges, he had made his father's boast good. The borders of the Rashtrakuta had finally intersected the sacred river. Chapter 47. Purifications. Between 718 and 741, the caliph tries to follow Muhammad's teachings exactly, while the emperor of Byzantium destroys icons and the pope is given a kingdom of his own. After the failed siege of Constantinople in 718, the caliph Umar II led the Umayyad Empire into its first reform. The empire was less than a century old, but already the tensions that ribbed it were stretching to breaking point. Almost at the same time as the siege of Constantinople, Umar II had noticed a troubling problem in the empire's administration. Muhammad, long before, had instituted a head tax, ordering Christians and Jews within Muslim communities to pay a fee in return for accepting the protection of the Muslim state. Theoretically, converts to Islam were at once freed from the obligation to pay the head tax, but the caliphs after Muhammad, administering a burgeoning empire that Muhammad had probably never envisioned, were reluctant to give up such a lucrative tax. More and more often, local officials forgot to exempt new converts from the head tax, and they simply went on paying it. As a result, almost all non-Arab Muslims in the empire were currently sending the head tax to Damascus. This struck Umar II, who was back to the exact prescriptions of the Prophet Radical, as corrupt. He declared that all Muslims, no matter their race or length of commitment to Islam, should be exempt from the tax. This made him immensely popular, but it ruined the empire's tax base, particularly since huge numbers of conquered peoples suddenly converted en masse to avoid the tax. However, Umar II didn't have to deal with the consequences of his reforms. He died a natural death in 720, and his successor, Yazid II, immediately reimposed the tax before the empire went broke. At this, Yazid II's popularity plummeted, and the biggest crowd of recent converts, the non-Arab tribes in Khorasan, rebelled. Not only did they rebel, They also sent a message to the Kagan of the rebuilt Eastern Khaganate, Mo Cho's nephew and successor, Mo Chilien, asking him for aid. Mo Chilien had followed up on his uncle's conquests by pushing the Turkish kingdom towards the Arab border, swallowing the land once belonging to the Western Khaganate and re-establishing a unified Turkish empire. Pleased at an excuse to push farther southwest, he sent his troops towards the Oxus, and a 10-year struggle between the Turkish and Islamic armies in Khorasan began. With the Arab armies occupied elsewhere, the Emperor Leo III took the opportunity to do some doctrinal house-cleaning of his own. He issued a command that all Jews in his empire be baptized as Christians. A few were, but many more fled, some into Arabic lands, others up north into the lands of the Khazars. And he began to campaign against a practice that had long disturbed him, the use of icons in Christian devotion. Constantinople was home to scores of icons, paintings of saints or of the Virgin Mary or of Christ himself. An icon, the Greek word eikon, meaning image or likeness, was more than a symbol and less than an idol. An icon was a window into the sacred, a threshold at which a worshipper could stand and come that much closer to the divine. Christians had been using icons as an aid to prayer and meditation for centuries, but a counter-thread of unease with these images had been stitched into Christianity from its beginnings. In the earliest years of apostolic teaching, Christians had been distinguished from followers of the old Roman religion primarily because they refused to worship images, and for the second and third century theologians, the use of icons veered perilously close to idolatry. Once the ancient Roman customs had died out, so did the risk that Christians would be drawn back into them, and the use of icons became much less fraught with danger. But a strong subset of Christian theologians continued to oppose the use of icons, not because of the danger of idolatry, but because painting an image of Christ suggested that the Son of God was characterized by his human nature, not his divinity. God, who was spirit, could not be pictured. If Christ could be, didn't that imply that he was not truly God? An image of Christ separates the flesh from the Godhead and gives it a separate existence. Arguments over the use of icons became a subset of the arguments over the exact nature of Christ as God-man, arguments that had been going on for centuries, despite a whole series of church councils making declarations intended to settle the matter once and for all. Leo III had a less subtle concern. He was disturbed by the tendency of his subjects to treat icons as though they were magic. During the siege of Constantinople, the patriarch Germanus had taken the most venerated icon in Constantinople, a portrait of Mary that was rumored to have been painted by the gospel writer Luke himself, and had paraded around the walls with it. When the siege lifted, far too many of the citizens of Constantinople chalked the victory up to the icon, called the Hoda Getria, as though it had been a sorcerer's wand waved over the enemy. This sort of thinking had no place in Christianity. Perhaps Leo III also felt some justifiable indignation in seeing the praise for his hard-won triumph given to the icon. Still, his actions over the next years, which nearly lost him the throne, are those of a man acting against his own best interests, something explained only by deep conviction. In 726, Leo decided to begin to wean the people away from their magical thinking. According to Theophanes, the Confessor, he was finally moved to action by a serious eruption of the volcano on Thera. The whole face of the sea was full of floating lumps of pumice, Theophanes writes, and Leo deduced that God was angry at him. As a first tentative act against the icons, he sent a band of soldiers to take down the icon of Christ that hung over the bronze gate, one of the main entrances to the palace. His fears about the over-reliance of the people on the icons were immediately justified. A mob gathered to find out what was happening, and when the icon began to come down, they rioted and attacked the soldiers. At least one soldier was killed. Leo retaliated with arrests, floggings, and fines. With amazing rapidity, the conflict spread into the more distant regions of the empire. The army in the administrative theme of Hellas, Greece, rebelled and set up their own emperor, declaring that they could not follow a man who attacked the holy icons. The rebellion was short-lived, and the new emperor was captured and beheaded, but feelings continued to run high. In every great city across the empire, iconoclasts, icon smashers, and iconodules, icon slaves, meaning icon lovers, argued, while in Constantinople, Leo III preached against idol worship. Iconoclastic bishops removed icons from their churches, while iconodules wrote long treatises defending their use. The memory of him who became visible in the flesh is burned into my soul, wrote the monk John of Damascus. Either refuse to worship any matter, or stop your innovations. For an icon lover, the philosophical problem underlying iconoclasm was its suspicion of matter, its willingness to relegate Christianity entirely to the spiritual realm, and to separate off earthly existence as fundamentally flawed. And, like all theological debates, the use of icons had a political edge. Iconodules also accused Leo III of having too much sympathy for Muslims, who refused to make images of living things. He was, sniped the icon-loving Theophanes, too much shaped by his teachers, the Arabs. To the West, Pope Gregory II waxed indignant. He was himself a supporter of icons, but more central than the issue of icons was Leo III's willingness to make theological pronouncements. He sent a sharp message rejecting Leo's pronouncements. The whole West relies on us and on St. Peter, the Prince of the Apostles, whose image you wish to destroy, he wrote. You have no right to issue dogmatic constitutions. You have not the right mind for dogmas. Your mind is too coarse and martial. More seriously for Leo, the Pope ordered his own flock to ignore the imperial commands to destroy icons. By this time, only a handful of cities in Italy still maintained any loyalty to the Byzantine emperor. Among them were the southern city of Naples, the port village of Venice on the northern Adriatic coast, Rome and Ravenna, where the exarch still lived. Much of the rest of Italy was ruled by the Lombard king Liutprand. Pope Gregory II's condemnation meant that the peoples in these territories now had a theological justification for finally deserting Constantinople. The Italian cities had been feeling the pinch of higher and higher imperial taxes for some time, and their populations welcomed the justification. The Duke of Naples actually tried to carry out the emperor's command to destroy the city's icons, and was killed by an indignant mob. In Ravenna, the exarch was killed by his own subjects, and in Rome, the Pope was acting with increasing disregard for the imperial stamp of approval. King Liutprand of the Lombards saw the opportunity to extend his own power at the expense of the emperor's. He attacked Ravenna and took away the port, although the residents of the city put up resistance and Liutprand was unable to penetrate the marsh. Ravenna was now no man's land, unable to communicate with Constantinople, and no